The Airplane Geeks podcast is proudly sponsored by the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association. Visit aopa.org/learn-to-fly for your introduction to the exciting world of aviation and flight. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 221 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. Now, if you're a first-time listener, welcome. If you like aviation, we think you're going to like this show. However, I'll warn you right now that this isn't the typical episode. You see, the East Coast of the U.S. is getting hammered by the storm of the century. Hurricane Sandy ran up the coast and turned northwest and rolled over Philadelphia, where David Vanderhoof resides. Lots of rain and high winds at his place. Meanwhile, here in Connecticut, we're just waiting for the 80-mile-an-hour winds to blow down trees and take out the power. At least for good, it's been fluctuating on and off. The third member of this show, Rob Mark, he's safely tucked in Orlando, Florida, for the National Business Aviation Association convention. That's the NBAA convention. So, given the uncertainty of continued electrical power, we thought it best to cancel our recording session this week. But we can't let you go for a whole week without the Airplane Geeks, so we've managed to put together something to tide you over until next week when we return to our normal format. Here's some of what we've got. David had a previously unreleased interview with Lieutenant Jay Kircher. He's with the U.S. Coast Guard Air Station Atlantic City. Those two guys talk about Coast Guard aviation. And we also have Steve and Grant from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast with their Australia Desk report. Also, our European contributor, Peter Johnson, brings us his Across the Pond segment. It's also possible that Rob Mark will send a brief recording in from Florida, and if he does, I'll mix that in too. As for listener mail, well, I know this works best with Rob and David here, but I hope they'll understand if I play a few recordings that were sent in. I think we want to get a little bit of that in this episode, so our listener mail backlog isn't quite so great for the next time. Okay, that's what we have in store for you this episode, so let's get started. Here's David Vanderhoof, our Airplane Geeks historian, at the U.S. Coast Guard Air Station Atlantic City.
This is David. I'm down at U.S. Coast Guard Station Atlantic City, adjacent to the Atlantic City International Airport. And I'm standing here with Lieutenant Jay Kirshner of the U.S. Coast Guard. Lieutenant Kirshner, thank you for being on the Airplane Geeks.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Tell me a little bit about Coast Guard Station Atlantic City.
Well, we opened up in 1998. We were combined from Air Station Brooklyn and Air Station Cape May. So we joined up, added more helicopters, and that's why we cover from up to New York or Long Island and all the way down to the Chesapeake Bay, to the mouth of Chesapeake Bay, as well as inland into D.C., the D.C. area as well.
And what helicopters do you use, or what aircraft do you have here?
We have 10 MH-65 Delta Dolphin helicopters. They are the newest model of our Dolphins, the fourth generation. And we keep a few, most of them up here in Atlantic City, as well as some down in D.C. for our facility that we use for air intercept mission in the Washington SFRA.
And how many missions do you launch a month, approximately, from here?
I think we average, it's about 40 saves a year. Missions, though, it would be well over that. I think it's 200 a year. And most of those are, you know, for flyer sightings or uncorrelated maydays. So we don't actually get a direct result. But about 40 of those a year, we actually pick somebody up off a boat or off the water where we actually retrieve a survivor.
And how exhilarating is going out to rescue someone and then retrieving them?
Oh, it's a great feeling. I mean, that's why most of us joined the Coast Guard, was to save lives. I'm one of the newer pilots here, so it's a little bit more exciting for me. I'm on duty right now, actually, and we picked somebody off of a fishing boat last night. He was complaining of some chest pains, and so we medevaced him about 60 miles offshore and took him to the hospital. And yeah, looking at his condition, he definitely needed some help.
And you said there's a defense aspect around DC. Do you want to just briefly go into that a little bit?
Absolutely. After 9/11, the airspace around the Washington District, it became an SFRA. So we are used for low, slow intercept. That would be basically your Cessnas or your typical general aviation aircraft. So our main mission is to help get information to the Air Force, to NORAD, essentially, so we can de-escalate the situation and also kind of get information. So generally, the people who we do intercept, they're lost or their equipment failed. They're not trying to do any harm. And so by getting there as quickly as we can de-escalate it so that less action is needed and the appropriate enforcement personnel can to meet it on scene when they land.
We have a lot of listeners who are younger and looking for careers in aviation. You want to tell me a little bit about how you got into the Coast Guard and your aviation career in the Coast Guard?
Absolutely. As I'm sure most people listening, I didn't know much about the Coast Guard when I was in high school or when I was younger. I always wanted to fly, and I was always interested in boating. I'm a lifelong sailor. But the Coast Guard is the smallest of the five branches. We actually have less personnel in the entire Coast Guard than the New York Police Department. And so I was looking into a possible career in the Navy and found out about the Coast Guard in my senior year. I applied and I was accepted in the Coast Guard Academy following my high school graduation. It's a four-year college, just like all the other service academies. You get a bachelor's degree and you also become an officer, a commissioned officer in the U.S. Coast Guard. Most of us go to our ships for a first tour. So I spent 2 years on a buoy tender up in Detroit. As well as an icebreaker, and then put my package in for flight school, and was accepted after that tour. So this is my first air station, and that's a pretty typical career path that you'll see, especially for academy grads. However, a lot of our pilots here are direct commissioned aviators, so they used to be in the Army or the Navy or the Marine Corps, flying helicopters for them, and they just transitioned over to the Coast Guard through a program that we have.
Where did you do training for aviation?
We train with the Navy and the Marine Corps down in Pensacola, Naval Air Station Pensacola, for the initial part, and then we go up to Whiting Field for the fixed wing and helo training portion. It's a little less than 2 years is the training. You get your wings, your naval aviator wings, and then you go to your air station, and it's at the air station and at our training center down in Mobile, Alabama, where we actually learned how to fly, in this case, the Dolphin or the Jayhawk, if you have that route. We also fly our fixed wing, or the C-130, and the CASA, the HC-144.
So tell me, what's it like to fly the Dolphin?
Oh, it's great. It's a lot more power, a lot more comms package than the training training helicopter that we had. I kind of like to call it the sports car of the rest of the Coast Guard aircraft. It's a little bit more maneuverable, a little lighter. One of the reasons why I wanted the Dolphin specifically is it's the one that will deploy on cutters. We actually don't deploy here in Atlantic City on the back of our cutters, but at other units they'll actually go riding on the ship. So it's nice, small, and maneuverable. Not as roomy as the 60, and certainly not as powerful. But it definitely gets the job done and gives us about 2 to 3 hours of flight time. And we can pick up, usually on average, about four people. But we can, in a real extreme circumstance, I've heard we fit as much as 15 people in the back of the thing.
Okay, that's sort of surprising. You get your fair share, being in the Coast Guard, of flying in bad weather. Do they give you additional training and preparation for that?
Absolutely. I mean, it starts in flight school. All the flight planning that goes into seeing the weather. However, our cases come up, and usually in the worst kinds of weather, And so, you know, we try to get airborne as quickly as possible, and you do a lot of that in the air, you know, that kind of flight planning. Some of our systems on board the Coast Guard aircraft will help us evade the weather. We have an onboard radar system that will essentially show the cells in front of us. That same radar actually helps pick up the surface boats and stuff, so we can find stuff in the water. And then we also have a pretty good comms package where we can talk to people on the ground continuously, and they can give us weather updates. The aircraft itself is not suited for all weather conditions. We can't fly, we're not supposed to be flying in thunderstorms and you know, severe turbulence and all that. But it's beefed up enough where, you know, we can take more than, I would say, a medevac helicopter, you know, a civilian medevac helicopter, because of the harsh environment that we put it in. Our 60s, though, those are the those are the real buses. That's why you see them up in Alaska getting those daring rescues, because the weather's pretty nasty up there.
And Lieutenant Kircher, you're saying that you have some new issues with laser pointers. You want to talk about that?
Sure. I want to say it's new. It's been a problem for quite a while. However, I don't think it's really known to the public, you know, which is one of the reasons why it's happening. It's just recently we've been getting a lot of incidences. Essentially what it is people will have a high-powered laser on shore, and they see us flying by. We fly at night, pretty much every night, low to the ground, offshore, near these beach communities where they sell these laser pointers. And they see us flying by, and they just see if they can hit us. I don't think they mean any ill will. They're just trying to have fun. And the impact that it has on us is that it could be damaging to our eyes. It is a risk for us. And so the most probable impact that it will have on us that day is if we do get hit, we are supposed to return. You know, it could be a danger. Our eyes could be hurt. And the impact that has is if we're out going on a case, it'll delay us getting help to wherever we're going that much more. But also if we're doing our training, we have to stop our training. We have to knock it off for that night. And that kind of starts hurting us down the road to get in the training we need. Starts kind of piling up, basically, after that. Within the last few weeks, we've been getting a lot of laser incidences, mostly off the beach and the Jersey Shore.
And, of course, it's even worse because you're usually flying with NVGs or night vision goggles, correct?
Well, the NVGs, if anything, they'll actually protect our eyes a little bit more. We are flying with night vision goggles most nights. There are some training portions that we have to do unaided without the goggles. Basically, if we have a malfunction, we still need to do the job without the assistance of the goggles. But if the laser shines directly in the goggles, it's not like the movies where the lights come on and everybody goes blind because of the image intensifier. There's a system incorporated with it where it'll actually, if anything, shut it down, so it'll stop transmitting that light to your eye. However, they sit away from our face, and most of our eye is exposed still, even with the goggles in front of us. There's definitely a larger chance that the laser will hit our eye directly as opposed to the NVGs.
Well, thank you. It's an important safety concern that we need to, in the aviation community, address with the general public.
Not just for the Coast Guard or for military in general. It's become a problem for the commercial industry. A lot of these aircraft are getting hit, and just basically more public awareness so that people realize the impact that it has for us, but also it has serious impact for the people doing it. It's a felony crime, and I'm sure they don't mean any ill will, but you know, it could have some impact criminally for those doing it.
Lieutenant Kircher, thank you for being on the Airplane Geeks, and thank you for hosting me down here at U.S. Coast Guard Atlantic City.
Welcome. I'm glad you could stop by before the air show, and happy to be here.
Now let's hear from Steve and Grant from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast with their Australia Desk report.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
Slow news week this week. I won't wake Grant up yet. Hey, no, nothing there. Struth, there's one.
No, I didn't black out. It was only 8 Gs. It was only 8 Gs. It was sustained. I didn't black out. Oh, hi. Hey, Steve.
Hey, wake up, mate. I found a news story this week in this collage of no news.
A news story? Quick, hunt it down and shoot it.
Quick, Grant, give us a dateline.
Excuse me. Dateline. 29th of October, 2012.
I tell you what, mate, you always know it's a slow news week in aviation here when they trot out our first story this week. They're talking about a third. Didn't we just talk about a second major airport for Melbourne? And now they're talking about a third.
Oh, God. You woke me up for that?
Yeah.
Third runway? Oh, come on. I mean, just because Sydney can't even get a second one happening and we're talking about our third, but that's beside the point.
I'll tell you what, mate, on the bright side, it's my local airport. It's just like 15 minutes down the road.
Oh, lovely little Turidon.
Yes, lovely little Turidon. So this is what always happens, folks, down here in Melbourne, at least in the local aviation news, when there's not much to talk about. And trust me, there hasn't been much to talk about this week as far as aviation news is. So we'll go with this one here in the Cranbourne Leader. Actually, Grant, that's my local paper.
Oh, there you go.
It says, update, Turidon flag for major airport. I might put him in parentheses there, Grant, again.
Yeah, I know. It's like, gee, yeah, okay, what do we got to do? We've got to lengthen the runway and strengthen the runway a heck of a lot. And that means delving into the swamp around it and also putting up with the people who live there and the fact it's a green belt and everyone who's going to complain about the fact that, A, they don't have an airport close by, but, B, if you put one there, it's going to be too close.
Yes. Now, as we mentioned, I think was it last week or the week before? Now, of course, Melbourne sits right at the top of a large bay, Port Phillip Bay, and over on the west is Avalon Airport. Melbourne Airport is right up to the northwest, and over here on the eastern side where Grant and I live, really the only major GA airport at the moment is Moorabbin. Now, of course, we know that the people that own Moorabbin Airport would love to close it because that land's worth hundreds of millions of dollars, and I wonder if their very sneaky media people have decided to insert this story about Turidon, which is right out there on Melbourne's outer southern fringe, just to keep it in people's consciousness. We know a lot of people that live around Moorabbin Airport, for example, would love to see it close as well.
Oh, yeah, but this could backfire on them and they could wind up with Moorabbin being beefed up for RPT. Woohoo! Hey. It already has minor RPT, like the guys off to King Island and all that.
Yes. Well, interestingly, billionaire transport magnate Lindsay Fox, who coincidentally owns the lease for Avalon Airport.
And Essendon.
Which he's doing a very good job of killing off, I might just say.
He's trying.
He says there's absolutely no need for that. And you know what? I think I actually, as much as it makes me ill, Grant, I think I agree with him.
No way.
Lindsay Fox does point out that it's taken them 35 years to get approval to develop Avalon Airport, and that's true. So, and that only came in the last couple of weeks. As you'd know, we reported that about 2 or 3 weeks back. So I don't know about the idea of having yet another domestic airport in Melbourne, which is a city of about 4 million people at the most. I don't think we really need 3 big domestic airports out here. But hey, Grant, that's just my opinion. I'd be very happy, on the other hand, if they started flying Boeings out of Turidon just down the road. not sure Mrs. Steve would be very happy about it, though. Well,
Boeings out of Turidon. I just have these pictures of Boeings with galoshes trying to get through the swamp. But you know, it's like that would give us 5 major airports because you'd have 2 internationals with Tullamarine and Avalon. And then you'd also have this one at Turidon as a domestic. And then you'd also have Essendon and Moorabbin as major GA, Bizjet and so on airports. And it's just starting to get nuts. The biggest problem I see when you've got so many different airports around the place is how on earth do you get from one to the other? Like, people complain about having to go down to Avalon to get a Jetstar flight when you can get some Jetstar flights at Tullamarine, but Jetstar and Tiger were looking to offer cheaper flights by flying out of Avalon, which for people where you are is a nightmare to get to. So how do you get there? You've got to have better rail. You've got to have better roads. Everything's got to be better on the infrastructure to get from point to point.
Absolutely. One of the things they could consider, you know, is setting up a ferry port to go across Port Phillip Bay. Somebody got on our side of the city and climbed on a hydrofoil or something like that and transited the bay and docked straight into a port over there at Avalon, which sits right on the other side of the bay. Well, there's your answer. See, I'm a genius, Grant.
Quick, go, patent it, quick.
Yes, I'm going to buy a sailboat as we speak. Hello, eBay.
Steve's roll on, roll off sails. Just don't try and use it when it's windy.
That's exactly right. Hey, Grant, did you mention Tiger Airways?
I did earlier, and I also mentioned wind. The two do seem to go together.
Absolutely. Grant, they've been engaging in spam, those little devils.
Oh, not spam, 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 lovely spam.
Lovely spam, yes. And of course, the funny thing about the spam list for Tiger Airways is that you actually have to opt into it. The only problem is when you want to opt out, they don't seem to care.
No. Their opt-out process has been less than stellar. And the Australian Communications and Media Authority has been telling them they've been very naughty people and to stop not unsubscribing people. And finally, the ACMA had enough and they hit Tiger with a $110,000 fine.
Boy, I hope they're not in a hurry for that money, Grant.
Oh, why? Do you think it could be routed through the same people that are still owing you a call since 2008?
That's exactly what it is, Grant. If they've got a complaint, they can wait in line. I've been waiting since 2008 for Tiger Airways to reply to my complaint.
Yes, and you're at the fast track queue.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Oh, mate. Well, I got to say, mate, this story is just inspiring me to sing.
Oh, my goodness, really?
Spam, 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 lovely spam.
Can't you just go back to sleep?
Yeah, probably.
You
night,
do that.
Dude.
Good night. Well, that must be the shortest Australia desk ever. Until next week, I'm Steve Isher and hello, Grant. Struth. Hope there's more news next week.
And now Peter Johnson brings us his Across the Pond segment with a little bit of European aviation.
Today, I'm joined by Tim Gresty, Managing Director at Cognitio, and this week we're going to have a look at the issue of super hubs. Tim, we've seen Heathrow historically being, I suppose, what we would all see as a hub, but with the lack of growth in the southeast, we've seen Amsterdam and Paris and some other areas start to grow. But of course, it's where the Gulf states are situated that real super hubs are now developing.
Yep, I fully agree with that, and I think we need to take great care when we analyse international super hubs. They're not necessarily where you would expect them to be. Who would have said 25 years ago that one of the world's greatest super hubs would be in a tiny little state, more or less covered in sand, tucked away in a what was viewed often as a backwater of the world?
And yeah.
It's quite a revolution.
Yeah, it is quite amazing. I suppose diversifying their economy into areas like aviation has allowed them to focus, and with partnerships like the one announced recently with Qantas, which has broken a decades of relationships through Hong Kong, Singapore, and with airlines like British Airways. We're seeing the real power of these airlines and these states coming through.
Fully agree. And I think if we look at Dubai, we see one example, and you mention about forward thinking. There, the Makhtoum family spotted the, if you like, the lack of oil in the sand years ahead and decided this was a way to go, an exceptional model. But then the other families, such as the people over in Abu Dhabi, have followed their example. And we now have a situation in Abu Dhabi where an emergent airline, Etihad, in a new airport has reached, well, the airport has a total throughput now of about 13 million people. It's not at the top yet, but they're growing at 10%, 12% a year, and over 50% of their passengers are transit passengers, and good margin ones at that.
Yeah, and with the airline alliances that we're seeing, it's bringing even more passengers through those areas, you know, like the Qantas tie-up. I believe they're code-sharing, so Qantas will no longer need to fly, as my colleagues described them, the red tails, up to Europe anymore, because they can simply transfer their passengers onto other flights.
I think we're beginning to see that as qualities of the traditional airlines have been kept so high, that there is a seamless transfer. And if you can get that key point, the transfer right at the airport, people don't mind so much swapping from one airline to another. Therefore, the desperate loyalty to one brand all the way through the journey is beginning to diminish.
Yeah, and how's this going to affect some of what we would recognise historically as the European super hubs? I mean, London, Paris, Amsterdam.
I feel that it will affect those airports that are not ready to invest courageously in developing their airports, and that is a very pointed remark aimed within the UK.
Yeah.
We've seen at Amsterdam tremendous development. I think there are 7 runways now. It can take you as long to taxi to the furthest runway as it can to do some short flights within the UK. We're also seeing at Frankfurt a very well integrated airport with adequate runway capacity. I also understand that at Charles de Gaulle, we're beginning to see that the hubbing is paying dividends more than just total passenger numbers. Their average number of seats or of passengers per flight is trending upwards, which must be good for airlines, for the airports, and for the environment. It would be good to see Heathrow following their example. My concern is we've left it very, very late indeed. And the talk at the moment about Boris Island Airport with 4 runways or whatever else in Maplin Sands.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, that's dreaming. That's the time scale of building the pyramids.
Yeah.
We really should get on with developing the airports now that we have. And a 3rd runway at Heathrow would enable it to adopt a proper hubbing status. It's slipping down the list of leading airports. It used to be number 2. Beijing has overtaken. Chicago is on the verge of overtaking. Tokyo is very close. Paris Charles de Gaulle, as far as the latest figures, has got a total passenger throughput of 61 million, whereas we've got Heathrow on 69 million.
Yeah.
And they're growing faster than we are. And I do believe we need to invest in the extra capacity where the airport is, if it is to develop into a proper hub.
Would one runway be enough, do you think?
I think one runway properly operated would enable the following. A focus on the 2 current runways for longer haul traffic, and there would need to be encouragements for larger aeroplanes, because Heathrow is well short of its target number of passengers per aeroplane.
Yeah.
It's about 140, 150 at the moment, and it should be like some of the American airports, like Atlanta, over 200.
Right.
So if you put the bigger planes on the 2 runways and then have the feed with smaller planes on the shorter runway, that would enable you to begin doing a hub job feeding in and feeding out. There is a second aspect to this, if I may mention it. There is huge environmental opposition to extra airport capacity in the southeast of England.
Yeah.
If one focused runway 3, that it could only be used economically by environmentally efficient shorter and medium haul jets and prop jets, you might have a win-win situation.
Yeah, interesting. Hadn't thought of that angle. And just taking that concept on then, some of those aircraft would be feeding into Heathrow. Is there a potential for regional airports to play a part in London's growth?
I think there is an opportunity to spread an amount of the traffic, but what I do not see is that the regional airports become the equivalent of Heathrow in terms of handling the big volume routes using big volume aeroplanes. You mentioned the 787 earlier in our discussions. You mentioned the 380. There are, of course, 380s operating regionally in the UK, particularly into Manchester.
Yeah.
It is doubly interesting that of the 3 flights with Emirates a day into Dubai, 2 are 777s, 1 is a 380. The 380s do seem to be better suited to what I'd call the big volume routes, such as Heathrow, Frankfurt, Paris, Charles de Gaulle into Dubai.
Yeah.
I think what we're seeing is that Heathrow's opportunity for growth is from feeding smaller volume aircraft in and out and supporting big international routes, and also having better ground surface support, such as high-speed rail. Manchester, Birmingham and others will grow, but to me that will be maybe mini hub traffic, but particularly point to point serving the regions in which they are based.
And we've seen that Virgin have stepped in to try and increase traffic between London and Scotland, London and Manchester. Do you think they have the capability to support some of the growth that we're looking at here?
I have great respect for Virgin as an operation. To have survived so long and maintain a good reputation in a fierce business is quite an accomplishment.
Yeah.
To a degree, I know that taking those slots into Heathrow is opportunistic, And if you take my argument, without a third runway, every small feeder aeroplane flying into those two big runways at Heathrow is keeping a bigger aeroplane out of circulation. We need to focus on bigger aeroplanes out of Heathrow to make the most of capacity, and that means having a third runway so people like Virgin, like British Airways, like even Flybe could operate into the airport without getting in the way of the bigger volume trade.
Well, Tim, again, fascinating as always. Could talk for hours. Thank you very much for joining us. Where can we find out about your business online?
You can find out about our business at cognizio.co.uk, and that covers our international marketing, but it has a particular focus within there on our airline work, which has been considerable through the years and international.
Tim, thank you very much for your time again and for joining us.
A pleasure. Talk to you soon. Bye.
This is Peter Johnson reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond.
Hi, this is Jesus Calderon from Barcelona El Prat International Airport Control Tower in Catalonia. Aviation is my passion. A traffic control, my duty, and the Airplane Geeks podcast, my weekly source of information, super interesting interviews, fun, and a lot more than a dash of culture.
All right, on to a little bit of listener mail. We're going to do some voicemail. First comes from Ian Kershaw. He sent in this voicemail. Here's Ian.
Hi guys, it's Ian Kershaw from Calgary, a minus 6 degrees and snowy day on, it would be Monday the 22nd of October, around about 3:20 in the afternoon. I've only just finished last week's episode, and in fact the week before on the mosquito, playing catch up because I found another love. Flaps podcast, a British podcast that I've thoroughly enjoyed, and I'm sure you're probably aware of. And then I also found some really neat stuff on motorcycling, and that took me back. Goodwood Festival of Speed and the Isle of Man TT. So I've been splitting my time between motorcycles and memories and different podcasts, but thoroughly enjoyed the show. The Mosquito, what a gorgeous plane, and I had the privilege of seeing one fly many years ago and was saddened to learn of its demise, well, probably about a decade ago, at near Barton Airfield in near Manchester in England. There is an effort in the UK again to put a mosquito in the air. It's called People's Mosquito. Their main concern, interestingly enough, is not the technical task of rebuilding one to flying condition. That's money. The expertise is there. That's a challenge in itself. But their main concern is the Mosquito engine outperformance is really very tricky. There's a number of interesting articles in the old Flypass magazines by a chap, I think it's Ian Ogilvy, who talks about flying the Mosquito and just what it takes when you get an engine out on approach or takeoff. And that's something that they're conscious of. But what a beautiful aeroplane, especially the fin. Look at a de Havilland Fox Moth, Tiger Moth, Puss Moth, look at the de Havilland Chipmunk, the Dragon Rapide, and that gorgeous fin just carries over, and you can see the lineage in the tail of the Mosquito, and that really is it's a piece of sculpted art as well as a magnificent magnificent aeroplane. And here in Calgary we have a Mosquito that's been languishing in the museum for decades and has recently been transferred to a Mosquito renovation group who are going to restore it to a static display. There's no way it's going to go back in the air. At a museum in Nanton, which a small village that also refurbished a Vulcan and has got the four engines running, and they often have engine run days. It's right by the highway. They towed it down the road a few decades ago to this plot of land, and they built a hangar around it. They've also restored a Blenheim and a bunch of other things. Amazing piece of work. Thoroughly enjoyed the show. Last thought, Antonov 225 was in Calgary on February the 8th, the day after I got home from a vacation. So I had to go to work, and I was the only guy that didn't go and take pictures of it. Absolutely pristine. It was obviously not been out of the shop that long. Comes into Calgary once or twice a year for major movement of oversized oil and gas equipment. The rest of the year we get some AN-124s. I think it was two Decembers ago I got two different AN-124s, two lunch times, two separate days, which was quite a treat, apart from the snowy weather. But to see it create its own snowstorm was quite something. Well, I'll let you go. Thoroughly enjoyed the show. Sorry I haven't been in touch all that often, but I'm still an enthusiastic listener. And along with Flying Podcast, Those Crazy Guys Down Under, and various other podcasts, my commutes to work every day on transit or in the car are made all the more pleasurable by having such things to listen and enjoy. Take care. Thanks again. Bye now.
All right. Thanks, Ian. Yes, the Flaps podcast is a great one. Very well produced. You can find that at www.flapspodcast.com. In the Goodwood Festival of Speed, next year that's going to be July 4th through the 7th, 2013. And we'll put a link to that site in the show notes so you can look for that. We got another recording from our listener, Micah, who we call our main man. And that's because Micah is a resident of the state of Maine. Micah wrote in that he's got a new pair of Logitech USB headphones with a mic. So he thought he'd give it a spin, see how they sounded. And here's Micah.
Hello, airplane geeks. This is Micah. And I'm writing in or calling in, whatever it happens to be, after just hearing episode 219 with Brett as a guest host. And it was wonderful to hear Cranky. And it made me realize something. It made me realize that I really miss Dan. Now, I don't just miss Dan as Dan, although I miss having him around. He was wonderful and terrific. But I miss having an airline guy there, a seat pitch guy. I mean, everybody else is wonderful and has terrific expertise, and we couldn't ask for better. But I feel like the podcast is really missing a seat pitch guy. Brett was wonderful to have there, and he couldn't be better in what he was able to add to the podcast, and was just did a wonderful job. But it made me realize that you really, it seems like there's something missing. It would be wonderful if Brett could be more regular, or maybe David Parker Brown, who's also an airline guy. But it was a great broadcast, a wonderful podcast, rather. I truly enjoyed it. And also got to say something about Cranky in terms of the Cranky Concierge. I've used his services quite a few times, and it's incredible. He tracks flights. He follows flights. I've used him through a range of flights as a travel agent as well. And yeah, you can do this yourself. But the great thing about using the Cranky Concierge service, you don't have to. If there's an emergency, he's there for you. It's absolutely a fabulous service. He saved me in terms of booking the flights more than what I ended up paying him for his services. Now, I shouldn't tell Brett that because he'll raise his fees. But it's worth every penny I paid, and I've got to just endorse him highly. It's a great podcast. Keep up the great work, and I look forward to hearing more of them.
All right. Thank you very much for that, Micah. The new setup sounds fantastic, and we do agree that we really do need a seat pitch guy to add to the conversation. We really do miss Dan, not only for his knowledge in that area, but just because, well, Dan is Dan, and we really enjoyed having him on the show. As for Cranky, Brett Snyder, yes, you're going to hear him again in a few weeks. He's going to be joining us again, and we really look forward to that. All right, I think I better wrap it up because the power's gone off and come back on a couple times, and I imagine pretty soon it's going to go off and stay off due to the storm. So why don't I wrap it up for this episode? Thanks for listening to us. Again, this is an abbreviated episode, kind of a micro episode, and we'll be back next week with the full program. Thank you for listening, though. Also, we want to thank our contributors, Grant McCarron, Steve Vischer from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast. Find them at planecrazydownunder.com. Also, Peter Johnson for the Across the Pond segment. You can find him at alphatangopapa.blogspot.com. And he's also got his own podcast now, of course, at aviation-extended.co.uk. No leading E on extended. You can find show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com. Also, we have a lot of photos on the blog posts associated with the episode. So even if you subscribe to this podcast, you may want to check the website from time to time, see some of the photos. Sometimes they're from us. Sometimes they're photos by some of our listeners, so we invite you to check those out. And be sure to follow us on Twitter and Facebook and Google+. Just look for Airplane Geeks. And we're also on Stitcher.com, where you can stream this podcast right to your mobile phone. If you want to send us email, that address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And of course, we have a listener line where you can leave us an audio message. That number is 361-GEEKS01. Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at www.brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Bye, everybody. The Airplane Geeks Podcast is sponsored by the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association. Visit aopa.org/learn to fly for your introduction to the exciting world of aviation and flight.